KZSU FM Stanford. Welcome to the first show of this new quarter on KZSU's schedule. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm very excited to have on Professor David Post of Temple University School of Law, author of the book In Search of Jefferson's Moose, Notes on the State of Cyberspace, which came out a couple of years ago from Oxford University Press. David is someone whose work I am familiar with and whose work I've read over the last few years. Sadly for me, this book slipped through my grasps when it came out in 2009, but I'm trying to remedy that error today by having David on discussing this fascinating book. The title itself suggests perhaps where this book goes, In Search of Jefferson's Moose. What David does in this book is fascinating. He takes the writings and ultimately the thought processes, to the extent we know them today, of Thomas Jefferson and runs those processes, runs his words through cyberspace today to see what we can learn from the analytical skills and analytical tests that Jefferson ran back at the founding of the country. I certainly don't need to tell this audience who Thomas Jefferson is, but suffice to say that for our purposes here, he was not only a prolific writer, but also a true Renaissance man, and that's a phrase that is overused. But David goes through the variety of areas that Thomas Jefferson was involved in and takes his writings, some of which comes from the Federalist Papers, but also elsewhere, some other books that are not as well known that Jefferson had written, and looks at his words and compares them to the kinds of issues that we face in cyberspace today. So it's a fascinating book, where the first half of the book is in many ways a history of Thomas Jefferson's thoughts in many of these areas. But then the second half of the book, Notes on the State of Cyberspace, which is a play on a book, the title being a play on a book written by Jefferson, talks about issues like code and layering and law and networks and so forth, the kinds of ideas and concepts that we're becoming familiar with in cyberspace. Certainly it did not exist anywhere near when Jefferson was alive, but the concepts that Jefferson writes about in the context of things like the river system in the United States, so important to the growth of the country, have interesting parallels to things like networks that we're going to be talking about today. So this is a fascinating book, really an enjoyable read, and I'm very excited to have David on today. As I mentioned by way of brief background, David is currently the I. Herman Stern Professor of Law at Beasley School of Law at Temple University, where he teaches intellectual property and cyberspace. He's also an adjunct scholar at Cato Institute, a fellow at the Institute for Information Law and Policy at New York Law School, and a contributor to the Vala Conspiracy blog. David is joining us by Skype from his home, and we are recording this show on March 24th for airing at the beginning of KZSU's quarter in April. David, thank you much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start off, David, with the standard question I ask all of my authors. Talk about the genesis of this project. Why did you write this book?
Oh, I worked on this book for a long time. Beginning, you know, sort of way back when, as it were, when I was actually did a little work when I was clerking for Judge Ginsburg on some of the work on the Federalist Papers. It was for a speech he had to give. It sort of introduced me to some of the writings kind of at the founding, and I just found myself purely as an avocation. I was practicing law at the time. Sort of got into, I found Jefferson to be a pretty fascinating character, like a lot of people do. And I just sort of was dipping my toe into some Jefferson biographies and reading a little of his writings, sort of for fun. I wrote something when I got into internet law, the early 1990s, when it was really just kind of starting. I wrote a little essay that was actually posted. I think the EFF posted it, actually, about kind of how a lot of the early debates, the early things people were fighting about in internet law, such as it was in 1993 or 1994, had kind of Jeffersonian and Hamiltonian echoes. That, you know, if you walk into a room, you could always sort of divide them, the Jeffersonians on one side and the Hamiltonians on the other. Those who were sort of thinking about growth and frontier and the movement and chaos and all of that, kind of on one side of the argument about the domain name system or ICANN or something like that. And on the other side of the argument were those who were sort of more concerned about the order and process and bringing everything into control and keeping things controlled. On the other side of the debate. And I sort of wrote that. It was sort of offhand in a way, that sort of Jefferson-Hamilton thing. It was a little flip. But the more I thought about it, the more sense it started to make. And I really did think that there was a Jeffersonian way of thinking about the net that seemed to resonate with people, that it was a Jeffersonian place in some regard, and I really started to sort of take that idea seriously. 15 years later, I found a way to say what it was I wanted to say about it, and it's a long answer to but it's a hard question. There was no moment when it started, but it kind of grew over 10 years or so, trying to figure out what was he up to, if you really ask that question seriously, what was Jefferson? What was the point of what he was doing? What held it all together? If you really want to answer that question, it took a while to do that, and then say, okay, now that I know something about that, what does that tell us about the net?
We have plenty of time, at least at this point in the show. Towards the end of the show, things get a little tighter to expand on some of these ideas. And for listeners that certainly listeners outside the United States that are not students of American history generally, if you would situate Jefferson in terms of his role in the founding of the U.S. and of course the drafting of our founding documents.
What? Well, I mean, right, Jefferson, there's the political Jefferson, who played, was among others, played a central role in the founding, author of the Declaration of Independence. I feel like I'm reading his epitaph. Actually goes away, leaves the United States, what was then just becoming the United States after the Revolution, and spends 6 very important years in Europe. While the Constitution was being framed, that's an interesting. Jefferson is away from the country, although Madison, who plays an enormously important role in the constitutional framing, and Jefferson were very close allies and close friends. He then comes back. He's vice president, he's Secretary of State, vice president, president of the United States for 8 years. Completely transforms the country. I think it is fair to say he's one of the truly transformative political leaders. In history, the country is a very different place after Jefferson is elected president than it was before he's elected president. But then there's 14 other Jeffersons. He was one of the great architects. He was a great linguist. He was a paleontologist of note. He was a botanist. Did some very important work about sort of agricultural. Breeding. He was always interested in sort of primitive forms of hybridization. He was a biologist. And each of these fields he actually made small but useful little contributions. He was a participant in an unbelievable variety of intellectual endeavors. The Renaissance man is the label we give to it, but that just obscures. You know, he doesn't get up in the morning and say, oh, I'm a Renaissance man. I've got to do, I've got to look at those fossils today, or I've got to talk about, do an essay on Anglo-Saxon roots. He does it because, he does all these things because they're connected to one another somehow. And that's one of the things I was trying to sort of figure out. I was more interested, in some respects, I became very interested in the in Jefferson the scientist. I thought that that really is a key to understanding what he was doing on the political and social side, is really to understand what was driving him with the fossils and the botany and the all the rest of the sort of the natural history that he was so fascinated with.
You know, it's you know, as you talk about Jefferson and his focus on science, you know, it strikes me that and it's always fascinated me that if you look at writings of people that are known today primarily as political philosophers or just giants of the founding of nations from that time period, that so many were also involved in not just a casual interest in science. You know, and I'm thinking of even, you know, in England, people like William Cobbett, who was known as, you know, was thrown out of the United States and, you know, perhaps second only to Thomas Paine in terms of importance of British citizens in the founding of the country, and he wrote books about botany and these very, you know, what today seem like very arcane topics, but were of critical importance there. Perhaps, you know, do you have any thoughts on what the connection is ultimately in that time period between science and these great political thoughts and ideas?
Well, I mean, it's a very interesting subject. I mean, you're right that something has happened over the past several centuries. It's complicated and more complicated for me too complicated for me to really understand it. That has divided. You know, who was C.P. Snow said the two cultures, sort of science and art. You know, Goethe was a great paleontologist. He was studying paleo. You know, he made very important contributions. You know, while he's writing Faust. I think we have less of that today, and it is a shame for whatever reason. I mean, what I can't say is that for Jefferson, I mean, what I think I learned, not so much in the abstract, but in the particular with respect to Jefferson, there was an intimate connection. There was something very important connecting his science to his overall worldview. It was a part of his worldview. I think one of the things I sort of discovered in doing this book was the whole point of the moose, really, was that one of the important things about the moose that he brings to Paris to show off in the hallway of his residence is that it was really big. Jefferson was almost obsessed with questions of scaling, where do animals get big, where do they get small, how do they get big, how do they get small. He was interested in scaling, you know, what are the sort of natural laws of growth and scale. That was a central part of sort of his science, and it made an enormous impact on his thinking, I think, with respect to sort of his politics. He thought about how you scale up Republican institutions. That was sort of the central problem of the political problem of the late 18th century for the United States. How do you get a government that is controlled by the people to reach across wide territories? Everybody understood that it could work in the New England township. But how's it going to work? You know, he's sending Lewis and Clark out to find out just how big a place this is. They don't even know how big it is yet, but it's really big. How could you possibly imagine getting Republican government to scale up to a territory that size? You know, Jefferson really helped solve that problem. And I am convinced, and I will believe to my dying day, that it was in part because he was thinking about scaling. I mean, he was thinking about that moose. He was thinking about scaling problems in the natural world, and large, small animals, large, small plants, etc. So that's the connection for him. It made I think it affected very deeply and very fundamentally the way he thought about the world.
We're chatting with Professor David Post of Temple University, author of the book In Search of Jefferson's Moose on KZSU FM Stanford. You know, David, you get to you know, a more closer focus on the book, which is where I want to go. This idea of using Jefferson's Moose as the title of the book, and using it as the prototype of the example of what you wanted what the reader to take away, I think. From the connection between Jefferson and cyberspace is an interesting one. I'm curious to know from a research perspective, how you made the connection. Because this is, and this may be a story that is well known. I certainly wasn't familiar with it. How did you come across this information, and where did you see it? Yeah.
I'm sorry, you mean the information about the moose story?
The moose itself, getting. I mean, this is more of a research question. Getting the information itself and making the connection. It's not one I think that would be self-evident to most people. So I'm curious to know how you put these two together.
Yeah, that's interesting. As I was doing the moose story was known. As I was starting to dig into the Jeffersoniana. I mean, there was an ocean of information. It's unbelievable, actually. The ocean of information out there about Jefferson. He's probably one of the two or three most written about people in history. You start to dive into this as I was doing. You come across the moose story here and there. He's the ambassador to France. He commissioned someone in New Hampshire to shoot a moose, American moose, with good antlers, he said, please. Skin it and dismember it and pack it up in a box and ship it over to France, where he will pick it up and bring it into his residence hall and have it reassembled. What was he doing? Why did he care so much? It's 1787, when there's an enormous amount of other stuff going on in the world. It was quite costly in both time and money to get this moose there. And I used to, you come across this story, I used to use it when I was talking about the ideas that eventually led to the book, which I was doing for years, so I was trying to think it through. I would often use that as a story just to sort of warm up the crowd, as it were, get people, it's the sort of the funny, the weird side of Thomas Jefferson. There is a really odd, eccentric side to Thomas Jefferson. This is illustrative of it. There are a thousand stories like this about him doing these sort of peculiar things, bringing a moose to Paris in 1787. So I would sort of loosen the crowd up about Jefferson. As I started to both talk to people about it and think about it, it did seem to me it sort of resonated in some way, that there really was something more than just eccentricity involved in this. I mean, I sort of forced myself to really ask the question, was he really serious? What was he doing? And it formed a good bridge, it seemed to me, between, let me put it this way. I actually began to go in search of the meaning of this moose. I mean, the book to me actually arose out of a kind of search for trying to figure out. Something told me early on that if you actually understood why he did this, you'd understand a lot about his thinking. Not everything, but a great deal about his thinking, and that would help me think through the cyberspace problems. So it did that job, in a sense. I realized that as I was thinking through the Jefferson material, it was sort of helpful to sort of keep this in mind, to answer that question, what was he up to, through the illustration of this one episode. I think, illuminated for me, at least, what the Jeffersonian viewpoint really is.
You know, it's interesting to think of Jefferson in these terms because, very recently at Santa Clara University was the first cyberspace, or cyber law, I should say, works in progress conference that brought together people that call themselves cyber law scholars. And unlike a lot of conferences that you go to where, for example, an intellectual property and you have people that write about one of the intellectual property disciplines, and usually it's one of three, and then trade secrecy is kind of out there, and a few people write about it. I'm among them. But when you go to a cyber law conference, you have people really who focus in a variety of disciplines. It suggests, I think, the interdisciplinary nature of cyberspace, not only as an area of scholarship, but also in terms of the issues that it raises. And I know that you teach internet law or cyber law. David, I'm curious to get your thoughts on that. It seems like Jefferson's wide range of interest goes fundamentally to what we're dealing with now with cyberspace law and policy, because there is no field that previously existed called cyber law. And as you know from early writings about this issue, both Judge Easterbrook's famous Law of the Horse article and Larry Lessig's response to it and so forth, there's been an ongoing debate about cyberspace or cyber law as an independent discipline, whether it's really just an amalgam of different things we already know. Does Jefferson's, I use this hackneyed phrase, Renaissance man idea fit nicely into the kinds of issues and the kinds of concerns that we have as cyber law scholars and policy activists?
Well, I mean, yes, but in an interesting way. One of the things that is appealing to Jeffersonians, I think, to people who have that temperament, is the notion of the frontier, the notion of the new world, Jeffersonian types sort of flock to places that are that have that frontier dimension to them, because that's what they enjoy, sweeping things off the table and saying, oh, we can sort of start fresh here. That to the Jeffersonians among us is and was the appeal of cyberspace, in a sense. It seemed to offer, still does in some ways, an opportunity to do kind of what Jefferson did, which is to imagine into being that it is a new world. Let's say that we get to start over again and rethink law, for example. I mean, that's kind of what the Jeffersonians did in the late 18th century, is they made it an act of, that was part of what the Moose was about also, as it turns out, was to say, we have things over there in the new world that you can't even imagine, and your old ways of thinking about things will not be suitable for the new world. It was an act of imagination that they found exciting and all that. I think if that's what attracts a lot of people, not everybody. There are plenty of Hamiltonians out there. Some are my good friends and colleagues. But that's what attracts the Jeffersonians, at least, to this field, because they do feel like they don't have. Jefferson was not a big friend of the dead hand of the past, as he called it. He really was always sort of looking forward in a way and thinking about creation without the baggage of the past weighing you down. It's not always an advisable course, but it's the Jeffersonian way of thinking about problems, is to say, if we could start fresh, what would we do? the Hamiltonian says, oh, well, you never start fresh. You have institutions, you have arrangements, you have this framework. The Jeffersonian says, yeah, but if we could, what would things look like? I think that's easier to do in respect to internet law. You can sort of get away with that in internet law. It makes it a very interesting and fertile field. It's a little harder to do that in other fields of law where the baggage is so overwhelming from the past. You can't just sort of shake it off and pretend that everything is new. We could sort of pretend that things were new in with respect to the internet. And if everybody pretends that they're new, of course, they actually become new. That's the beauty part, as we used to say in Brooklyn.
We're chatting with Professor David Post of Temple Law School, author of the book In Search of Jefferson's Moose, Notes on the State of Cyberspace on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to listen to the show. David, let's turn to some of the implications and issues that you discuss in the book. And I'll start with really what is a very top-level question, but I think it's a good one to start, this portion of our discussion. Given the current problems in cyberspace policy, where would Jefferson's insights, in your view, be most useful? Is there a particular question or concern or issue that we have today that you think Jefferson could help us understand better than our current understanding?
I think that's a hard way to think about it in a way, sort of the particular. I don't want to give the impression, I hope I'm not leaving the impression with your listeners, that I somehow think I'm sort of channeling Thomas Jefferson. I'm not. I am trying to get the perspective and apply the perspective because I think it's a valuable perspective onto things. But I often get questions like, "What would Jefferson think about X?" That are very difficult to make me a little bit uncomfortable in some ways.
So you're not a clairvoyant.
I'm not clairvoyant.
Okay, all right.
I think the Jeffersonian perspective takes a fairly absolute position, for example, on the freedom of speech. Jefferson is really over on the absolutist side of the. This is a slight oversimplification, but only a slight oversimplification. That to Jefferson and the Jeffersonians, really the most important, it was the fundamental job I shouldn't say it that way. To make Republican government succeed, you have to give the widest berth possible to freedom of speech, press, conscience, thought. Those are all bound up together. Making sure that they stayed outside the reach of the state was of paramount importance, that the state can't interfere with how we think and how we talk to one another. And that's sort of rule number one. And that gives you a perspective on things in cyberspace. It gives you a perspective on a lot of things. People can disagree with that. There are people who do. But if you take that as rule number one, it gives you a perspective on events in the Arab world that are taking place right now, about how important it is, how powerful that is, when you enable the people of a country who were unable to communicate with one another before, to communicate with one another. An enormous power in that. and that it is normatively, as we law professors like to say, and that's a good thing. More communication is to be preferred to less. I think that's a Jeffersonian maxim. If he didn't say it, I'll make it up as a Jeffersonian maxim. But it is the sort of, I think you, that's all sort of always the answer. It's a little bit simple-minded. It loses some nuance, perhaps, and there are certainly, we could certainly argue about it. But that gives you a perspective on questions you're always thinking. I think if you find this viewpoint, this perspective congenial, I think that's one of the things one is always looking for in analyzing a problem. Is this about someone choking off speech, or is this about someone giving a new platform for expression? And if it's the latter, that's a thumb in the scales. I think the Jeffersonian perspective, as I was saying before, is also about looking forward and not back. Again, that's an arguable proposition in many circumstances, that the question of it comes up all the time in copyright law. We have this baggage of copyright rights. If they take the Google Books settlement. Mm-hmm. So now we find out as of yesterday that the Google Books project, at least temporarily, is not going to go forward because the judge did not approve the settlement with the authors and the publishers and the rest. Now, I have not, caveat, I have not read that. I have not read what the judge wrote about this. I'm not sure about the precise grounds on which he is denying the settlement, so I'm not giving sort of a detailed legal opinion about that. But the Jeffersonian is thinking about the Google Books problem in this way. One is, it's a looking forward. I mean, I want this project to succeed. This is a fabulous resource for the people of the world to have every book ever printed. It's the Library of Alexandria. It's where everyone has instantaneous access to. I mean, what could be that? Is in a Jeffersonian universe, that would be a treasure to have that kind of access. There are things I'm worried about going forward, to be sure, that might make it not such a good thing. There are privacy implications of having Google in control of all of this resource and what they can do with the information. I mean, there are all sorts of problems going forward. I want to think those through, make sure that it really is. It realizes its unbelievable potential for good. And there are problems looking backwards. There are the authors who have all these rights built up and things in the past that are concerned about how those rights will be implicated in the Google Book settlement, copyrights, primarily among them. The Jeffersonian is a lot less interested in the second group than it is in the first group of objections. I don't want the author's rights to play an undue that were granted in the past to play an undue role in structuring the future. That's a Jeffersonian. It doesn't give you an answer. It doesn't tell me where I come out on the Google Book settlement. I'm not even sure where I do come out on the I'd have to think more about it. But that's the way I think it's part of the Jeffersonian the mindset. And I think a lot of people share it, is just the dead hand of the past. We want to there are many ways in which the dead hand of the past necessarily impacts on everything we do in the future. Jefferson was a little simple-minded about it, but there is a way in which you look at problems and try to minimize the effect of decisions that were made by people who are now dead in controlling what we can make of our future.
You know, and I think, you know, and David, respecting the fact that I didn't mean to imply that I was asking you to tell me what Jefferson would say.
No, of course
not. Yeah, more a matter of what Jefferson's writings would suggest in how we should think about these issues. But to draw that out a little bit further, and as I mentioned in the introduction, oftentimes, and, you know, it makes sense for a book like this, you are properly analogizing to issues that Jefferson faced in his day compared to issues we have today. And so, as I mentioned, I think one interesting comparison is the comparison between our concern today about networks and how networks communicate with each other and connect to the river system, the natural course of water that existed and continues to exist, although we've altered it with dams and so forth since Jefferson's time, that was largely responsible for the growth of the nation. And the broader question I have is one, again, that gets to cyberspace policy and how we think about the law, which is that there is often an interest by judges and by students and by scholars to analogize current technology issues to offline or non-technology scenarios, partially because we don't have the experience with the technology to draw a lot of analogies. It's still a relatively new area, but also because they're helpful in understanding these issues. And I'm curious, given that your book so heavily focuses on drawing those comparisons, if you have a general view regarding offline analogies used by judges in technology cases.
Well, I do have a view, which is, I think that analogies, you have to have some sort of analogy or metaphor for anything that is new, because nothing is entirely new. It's like things we've seen before. And at least in the law, you have to say, is this more like this or this? I mean, I think it's an inherent part. The analogizing process is an inherent part of, I guess I don't want to say thinking in general. What do I know about thinking in general? But I do think it's an inherent part of thinking about problems the way lawyers and law professors think about problems in the law. We have to do it. We have to find the analogy. So the question isn't whether should you find an analogy or not. The question is, how do you know when you have a good one? You know, I was just doing this actually in class the other day. There are cases in sort of the early cyber law cases where you know, it made a difference whether is America Online in the old days, the AOL chat rooms and all, are they a newspaper? Are they a publisher of a newspaper, or are they just are they like a seller of a newspaper? That which of those analogies you bought had enormous implications for its legal status and its liability for various things, defamation, among others. Is filtering is putting a filter on a library computer that is attached to the internet, is that like blacking out parts of the library, or is it more like just not getting a subscription to certain kinds of magazines? That makes a difference into which of those analogies you buy makes a difference in terms of how you conceptualize the constitutionality, in that case, of whether libraries can use filters. I think that's an inherent part. That's how we think in the law. And we can't eliminate the need to find what's this like, because we have to precedent-based system in a very fundamental way. We're looking, the law is retrospective. It does look backwards and say, what have we said about this phenomenon in the past? And that, well, we haven't said anything about this precise phenomenon in the past, but what's it like? You know, the first time they had, the first, you know, trespass to chattels case, I assume, and, you know, 1311 was somebody took my shoes, and I should have a remedy for that. And the judge says, yeah, you got a remedy for that. And the next one wasn't my shoes, it was my shirt. Mm-hmm. And they had to say, oh, well, my shirt's just like my shoes. it's just you always presented with a new set of facts. You're always looking what's it like. So cyberspace just poses that problem so deliciously in a way. I mean, it comes up so much. What is this like? We really don't have – we've never looked at a – P2P, the file sharing system, is that like a DVR, or is that, you know, that really is something that is hard to characterize, but it just makes the problems more intense and more visible in cyberspace law than they are in other areas of the law. But it's something I think we do everywhere in the law, have to.
And you know, and you mentioned earlier, which gets to that issue, you know, the stark concern that many policymakers as well as activists and commentators have concerned about in connection with the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement and other although the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement has been negotiated largely in secret, and so it's hard to know exactly what's going on there, but certainly there was concern about something along the lines of a three strikes and you're off the internet rule, where one could violate a certain set or a particular law a certain number of times and the government would throw you off the internet. And this was a somewhat abstract idea until, as you mentioned, recently with the revolutionary activities in countries like Egypt and those countries literally shutting down the internet. And there's been some technological writing about how that was done and mm-hmm. the fact that you don't have as much private sector involvement or any private sector involvement in internet access in countries like Egypt that you do here, and so it would be more difficult. But the larger issue is this question of speech and the ability to control it. Do you have a view on, and not in terms of whether it's good or bad, but a view of how countries like Egypt and China, to a lesser extent, have been able to cut off internet access, and again, where Jefferson's writings could help us figure out how to approach those problems, beyond saying that it's not good and we don't like it?
Well, saying that it's not good and we don't like it is a very important first step, actually.
Right.
I don't know that there's actually much else that I can do, other than to say what the internet has made clear. I think this is a very important moment that we are living through for many reasons, but with particular respect to the sort of the relationship between the internet and governments and society. I mean, I think this is something of a turning point in with respect to the Arab revolutions that are taking place. I think the it makes it clearer, I think, than it was in the past, that there are really two kinds of governments in the world. There are those that allow their citizens to speak freely, to communicate freely with one another, more or less, with nuance, but more or less, and those that really don't. And they had excuses in the past maybe for wanting to, you know, control the state television network and control the state radio and control the state telephone system and all that. But those are sort of breaking down now. There's no you have to pull – they want to pull the plug as Mubarak did at one point, pull the plug. I think the most interesting thing to me, I guess to the Jeffersonian in me, about those events in Egypt is not that he was able to pull the plug. I sort of knew that. I think people understood that it could be done. You could go dark through a variety of means, whether it was control over the ISPs or control, as it was in this case, over the cable, one major cable that's going to Italy and connecting them to the backbone. Cut that cable and it goes dark. What's interesting to me about that is not that it figured out a way to go dark, but that he brought it back on. It's very difficult in the mind. I mean, imagine what happens when a country like Egypt, the internet goes down. It's not just the protesters who can't communicate with one another. Nobody can communicate. That country is dependent enough upon the communication technologies. The banks can't work if they're not. The military can't communicate with one another when you make the internet go down. Commercial operations, they're doing business with people in Europe and all over the nobody's getting anything done. That's not making the rest of the country very happy. So, yeah, you know, maybe Burma can, North Korea can probably turn it off. Burma can turn it off. But there are not many countries that can really afford to do that. Bahrain can't turn it off. Not if they want to participate in the modern world at all. So that's heartening, I think, actually, too. I think the power of this network, I think, was demonstrated, and the reason I think it's a turning point is that I think it's no longer in the there are a lot of people who still maintained up through 2010 or what have you that this is all sort of a gee whiz phenomenon. It's just like the television on steroids or something. The net. It's really not that much going on here. It's a great way to go shopping and to waste your time and all that. That sort of talk, I think, we're going to hear a lot less of. I hope we're going to hear a lot less of in the days going forward. We have to take this phenomenon seriously because it is a very serious change in something very fundamental, which is how we communicate with one another. And it has the potential to really change the world.
We're getting to what I call the unfair portion of the show, where I ask questions that you may not have time to answer as fully as you'd like. And it gets me to this issue and one that you address in the book, which is the idea of cyberspace exceptionalism, the idea being that cyberspace is new and that therefore we need new laws as opposed to the other general view, which is that we don't. Do you, as you look at, and I think you've alluded to it, but as you look at the events recently, do you think that we more firmly need new laws to deal with issues like social networks and their impact or their ability to connect people in ways that change governments? Or, in fact, is this a scenario that the law as it currently exists can adequately handle?
Right, that's a complicated question that I could spend more time answering.
Exactly. So I'll ask you to answer it in two or three minutes.
I will. The laws played an interesting role. I mean, in this, I don't know that we need new law. One of the things that struck me early on, I still have this book from I think 1997. A compilation of internet laws. Introduced that year. It's like 600 pages long. Everybody, you had to make law about it. We did some very important things in the law that helped to bring about the Facebook revolution, if you will, providing immunities to service providers, to intermediaries. There are two provisions in federal law, as that give very broad immunities to online intermediaries, immunizing them from the libel claims of libel based upon what their users may be saying, and against claims of copyright infringement based upon what their users are doing. That's a terrible oversimplification of two important and complicated provisions of law. But
are you referring primarily to Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act?
230 of the Communications Decency Act and Section 512 of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act,
right,
which does the same sort of thing. If we did not have those, my proposition to you is, if we did not have those provisions of law, you wouldn't have Facebook, you wouldn't have YouTube, you wouldn't have Twitter, you wouldn't have Tumblr, you wouldn't have Flickr, you wouldn't have Craigslist, you wouldn't have .. You wouldn't have the whole user-generated content social networking universe was built on top of those immunities, because without that, the potential liability is staggering for a company like, let us say, YouTube or Facebook, that is hosting terabytes of data, some of which may be, much of which may be either libelous or certainly copyright infringing all the time. So the law, I've just started to, the events in Egypt have made me sort of think back on those laws a little bit, to think, I think Congress actually got it right in some very important ways back then, though we criticize them a lot for the stupid things they do. We should at least give them some praise for the reasonably intelligent things they do. And these were reasonably intelligent things. These were very important for the growth of the net and are representative of, I think, the kinds of things, I guess, that law can do to really help foster growth and innovation and creativity and expression and all the rest.
So we're at the point now where I do want to ask you a few questions, David, as far as not looking forward in a crystal ball sense, but looking forward in terms of where you think we should head with cyberspace policy. And I mentioned ACTA early on, and this is a controversial law as much on procedure as substance because of the what I perceive to be unnecessary levels of secrecy associated with the negotiations. But also the substance of it. Do you have based upon what we know of ACTA, do you have a view of ACTA and its proposed impact on cyberspace policy and the Internet itself?
Oh, goodness. Yes, although, like a good lawyer and law professor, not knowing exactly what it says.
Right.
The process has been appalling. I'd say it much more strongly than you did. It's been appalling. The United States should not be participating in these sort of secret, behind closed doors negotiations with, we don't even know who they're negotiating with or about what with respect to ACTA. I just found that is really appalling. The substance seems to be another example of, look, the intellectual property rights holders are the tail that's trying to wag this internet dog over and over and over again. That's sort of how it seems to me ACTA is another example of overly punitive, overly restrictive rules to protect what is certainly worth protecting and important to protect, which are the sort of existing internet intellectual property rights holders, but in a way that is so destructive of potential growth and innovation in the net, which is ultimately more valuable to us, that we have that growth. This is the same conversation we had about the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, in a sense. If you protect the service providers, yeah, the rights holders are not happy about that immunity, believe me. But if you protect the rights holders, we will get the growth. If you protect the service providers, we will get the growth in this medium that is unimaginable, actually, as of 1998. And they were right about that. ACTA is sort of reenacting the same discussion, the same battle about overprotection of these rights, in my view. So about that, I'm not sanguine. But I think the problem is kind of deeper than sort of ACTA. I think this is the moment at which we have to somehow think of ourselves as participants in this global phenomenon. We are sort of citizens of this global network and need to take it seriously in a way that I'm not, and its law seriously, in a way that I'm not sure that people quite have done in the past. That this is a global resource of immense value. And we should not let anybody sort of tinker with it without at least knowing what they are doing and without a full airing of exactly what it is they're doing and why. Because we now all have a stake in this global interconnectedness that we have built up. And I think that's for me, that is in a sense the project for the next whatever 10 years or so is sort of how do you do that? How do you build a constituency? Jamie Boyle's been talking about this for a while, about sort of the new environmentalism, as it were. How do you get people conscious of the environmental movement was very successful in doing that, getting at least people conscious of these things in their decision making, in their thinking about the world. How do we do that for the net, in a sense, a sort of new act, make people think about it as something they have a duty to protect? That's I think part of the project.
David G. Post, a professor at Temple University School of Law, author of the book In Search of Jefferson's Moose, Notes on the State of Cyberspace. David, for those people that are interested in learning more about your work and your next projects, which I'd be curious about as well, where can they go?
I've got a webpage at www.davidpost.com. which sort of gives you, brings you to my page with writings and the Moose book, links to whatever it is you want. There's also, if you go to myspace.com/DavidGPost, you can also hear my music, which I'm also interested in, but that will be the subject of another conversation.
You've said it. I wouldn't be a good interviewer if I didn't follow up at least for 30 seconds. Tell us very briefly about your music.
Oh, I'm I play guitar. I played in a band in Washington, D.C., Bad Dog, for about 5 or 6 years. And I play with this group called The Erratics, David Post and The Erratics. And I write some songs, and I play some instruments, and it's pretty good.
Oh, well, I look forward to listening to it then.
Yeah.
Well, great. Well, David, thank you so much for joining us today on the show. I mean, I certainly invite you back to continue our discussion. And again, thank you for putting this book together, which I think was, like I said, a really interesting read and insightful one. In Search of Jefferson's Moose: Notes on the State of Cyberspace. Well, thanks.
Thank you very much for the kind words. And it was fun to talk to you.
I'm very excited to mention a number of guests upcoming this quarter on KZSU. Among them, Professor Andy Hiley and Scott Gaylord, my colleagues at Elon University School of Law, discussing online sales taxation. Professor Jennifer Urban, the director of the Samuelson Law, Technology, and Public Policy Clinic at UC Berkeley. Professor Dan Soliv of George Washington University Law School, author of Nothing to Hide, The False Trade-Off Between Privacy and Security. Kevin Paulson of Wired Magazine, author of Kingpin, How One Hacker Took Over the $1 billion Cybercrime Underground. Kevin Kelly, also of Wired Magazine, author of What Technology Wants. Adam Pennenberg of New York University, author of Viral Loop, From Facebook to Twitter, How Today's Smartest Businesses Grow Themselves. Pamela Long, co-author of a fascinating book on the history of the obelisk, and appropriately titled Obelisk, A History, as well as Professor Mario Biagli, discussing his fascinating work on Galileo. So several science historians this quarter, and I'm looking forward to chatting with them. As always, you have a number of ways that you can listen to KZSU, KZSU's Hearsay Culture. The main way is live on KZSU. As I record this show, I have to say I am not certain when the show will air this quarter, although traditionally it's aired Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time. So I will go with that time, although you will know by the time you listen when the show actually does air. But you can also get the show by going to several podcast links, the first being in iTunes, by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society and going to that page where you can find not only Hearsay Culture but any events occurring at CIS. You can also get the show by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous 130-plus shows as well as the upcoming schedule. And lastly, you can also get the show by subscribing to CIS's RSS feed at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com, particularly any guests that you think should be on the show. By way of example, a previous guest, Professor Mike Madison at Pitt Law, recommended Professor Biagli, and I'm very excited to have him on the show. So please send me those suggestions and any feedback you have on the show. I always welcome them, and I look forward to receiving that information. Thanks again for listening to Hearsay Culture. I hope you enjoyed the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.